This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dawe Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
With me on the line is Dr. Robert Dunn, who is the Alexander von Humboldt Fellow at the University of Munich. And Robert, you have done quite a lot of work with X-ray astronomy and supermassive black holes. So do you want to just take us through some of your early research?
In terms of my studies of supermassive black holes, their effect on their surroundings, I've looked at clusters of galaxies. Now, clusters of galaxies are the most massive object in our universe at the moment. They're so massive, in fact, that they're still forming. They haven't had time to collapse to their final state since the Big Bang. Because they are so massive, rather than only seeing the galaxies, the stars, and what we usually associate with what you can see when you look up into the sky, there are all kinds of things present in a cluster which are not normally visible. And in this case, what I'm interested in, or what I use, is something called the intracluster medium. It is a very, very hot, but very, very tenuous gas, a plasma, and it's so hot, in fact, that it emits X-rays. And this gas bathes all the galaxies, so that when you look at a cluster of galaxies with an X-ray telescope rather than a normal optical telescope, what you see is an amorphous blob of stuff, rather than all the individual galaxies looking all pretty as spirals or ellipticals. This amorphous blob of gas is quite good, because it exists throughout the cluster. It allows us to study the cluster as a single object, rather than to study it as a collection of individuals. So we can look at the cluster as a whole, as a single object. Because this gas is sufficiently hot, it's around 10 million degrees or so, Celsius or Kelvin, makes no difference, it emits X-rays. It's sufficiently thermally warm that instead of emitting red light or infrared light, it's emitting all the way up into the X-ray band. And this is why, when studying this gas, we use an X-ray telescope, which has to be in space, because the Earth's atmosphere does very well at blocking all the X-ray light. We've got this nice amorphous blob of gas, and we can see it in a cluster. And now I have to change tack and explain a bit about black holes, and then I'll see how the two interact. At the center of a cluster of galaxies, you tend to have, or very often you have, a single overly massive galaxy. It's bigger than a standard normal elliptical galaxy, and they even have a special name for it, the brightest cluster galaxy, or even the central cluster galaxy. And at the center of most galaxies, as we now know, including our own, there is a supermassive black hole sitting there. Yeah, millions of solar masses or billions of solar masses. Some of these black holes are swallowing material. They're eating, they're feeding, they are what we call accreting. Material from their surroundings is falling onto them and being swallowed from our universe rather. However, by some mechanism, which, you know, it's still being discussed exactly how it works, not all the material that ends up falling towards the black hole is actually swallowed by it. What happens is that somehow some of this material is ejected from the black hole, what we assume is along the axis of rotation of the black hole, and these jets of material travel extremely fast. They are relativistic. They are traveling at a very large fraction of the speed of light. And of course, these things now zoom out from the center of the galaxy and out into space. If they don't interact with anything, they head off for thousands or millions of light years out from the galaxy and out from the region of the black hole. What of course happens is that if you have one of these jet-emitting supermassive black holes, these are also called active galactic nuclei, because the nucleus of the galaxy, the black hole, is active, it's emitting these jets of material. If you put one of these in the center of a cluster of galaxies, these jets are going to interact with that hot X-ray gas I mentioned earlier. Now, this interaction is quite useful because we can see both the jet itself, which emits in radio waves, and we can see the stuff it's interacting with, the hot X-ray emitting gas. And what we find is that the interaction actually works in a very peculiar way. The jet basically inflates a bubble.
Because I suppose there's not very much more heating you can do to a 10 million degree load of gas.
Well, there is some heating you can do, and thank you for reminding me. That is something I want to come on to in a minute. But basically, the jets themselves consist of a mixture of electrons, either then positrons or protons. We're not sure actually what the positive part of the plasma is in that case, but also magnetic fields. And this makes this radio-emitting plasma quite connected. It doesn't like mixing very well. When you blow this jet into this hot thermal plasma, the radio plasma all stays nicely connected and you end up forming what is basically a bubble.
So it's a bit like injecting some engine oil into a glass of water.
It's a similar sort of idea, yes. Yes. You know, the two fluids don't mix, or don't mix very well anyway. So the jet pushes this hot X-ray gas aside and fills the replacing cavity with the radio gas. And therefore it's quite useful. You look at the radio image, you look at the X-ray image, and what you find is there's a dark patch in the X-ray image where you pushed all the gas out of the way, and you've got a bright patch in the radio image. And if you can make everyone then go cross-eyed at this point, you find that the radio bright patch lines up with the X-ray dark patch. But that's then quite useful in terms of studying how much energy is coming out of this black hole. We know these jets are travelling at around, you know, basically the speed of light. They can't go faster, but they're not much less. But we don't know how much energy this jet is carrying. Having created a bubble, a cavity, you can use actually very, very simple arguments from basic thermodynamics. So, you know, things, if you do end up studying physics or engineering in university, things you'll study in sort of the first or second year, so fairly simple for concepts, to get an estimate on how much energy is being carried by this jet in order that it inflates this bubble. And this is quite useful. This is the first time we've actually been able to see, firstly, that black holes have a mechanical effect. They're not just bright in terms of the light they're emitting. They're also emitting a large amount of pushing power into this central regions of these clusters. And that is quite useful because, as you said, this gas, although it is at 10 million degrees, you can't do much at heating it. You know, it's already fairly hot. The problem is that because we see it in the X-rays, we therefore know that this gas is cooling. It's emitting radiation. You tend to find if you put something hot somewhere, it'll emit infrared radiation until it cools. In this case, you've got a 10 million degree gas that's emitting X-ray radiation because it's hot, and therefore because it's losing energy via these X-rays, it is also going to be cooling. And if you have gas cooling, it'll cool all the way down until it will land on the central galaxy, where it can form stars. So this gas cools. Cooler gas can't exert as much pressure. I mean, think about it, when you boil a kettle, the hot vapour, the steam, what we see as steam, escapes the kettle because it's not being confined by the atmosphere. So if you heat something up, the pressure goes up. Mm-hmm. But therefore, if you cool it down, its pressure goes down. And therefore, all this gas cools, the pressure goes down, it all flows towards this central galaxy.
Okay.
Where you'd expect to see it form stars. The problem is that when astronomers have looked, they don't see any of the stars. They don't see sufficient stars being formed, and they don't see enough of this cool gas. They see it at 10 million degrees, but as it cools, you'd expect it to see it at 5 million degrees and at 1 million degrees and all the temperatures as you go down. And we don't see it in this cool between 1 and 10 million degree portion. So therefore, this energy injected by this supermassive black hole could be a way of preventing this gas from cooling and therefore ending up with all these phenomena that you'd expect but don't see.
So the black hole is still radiating enough that it keeps the plasma outside warmed still to the 10 million degrees? Or because you said we couldn't find it in the 1 to 10 million degree category.
The problem is that, to be honest, we don't know quite. You've got this jet that's carrying large amounts of mechanical energy because it's moving fast. It's got kinetic energy.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the gas isn't cooling because we don't see the cool gas. We see the hot gas, but we don't see the cool gas. And also what we find is we tend to see these jets and these bubble structures in clusters where you would expect the gas to be cooling exceedingly rapidly. What you do is you look at your cluster and you say, okay, this gas should be cooling. I can see it in the X-rays, the gas should be cooling. I look in lower temperature X-rays where I should see this cool gas, but I don't see any of the lower temperature X-rays. I look at how many stars this galaxy is forming, and I don't see that many stars being formed. Therefore, something is preventing this gas from cooling. What you also then find is you find this supermassive black hole at the center that's injecting energy into its surroundings. And it turns out that, you know, the amount of energy that you expect that's being lost by the gas by emitting X-rays is about the same, give or take a factor of 10, as the energy that the supermassive black hole is injecting via this jet. And so what is a quite nice sort of picture you could have is there's some sort of feedback loop going on. So you have a cluster, the gas cools a bit. Some of the gas does cool all the way down to the center of the galaxy where the black hole can interact with it, it can swallow some of it, but also some of it goes back out into the cluster and does the heating. And therefore you prevent some of the gas from cooling, but you sort of have a nice steady state where some of the gas cools, falls on the black hole, but that then prevents most of the other gas from cooling by injecting this jet. It's a very nice conceptual picture. It works very well. The problem is with all the details still need to be worked out. You basically inflate what you could look at as a balloon of this radio-emitting plasma, but how do you transfer the energy from one plasma to the other over a long...
Especially when they're not actually mixing very well.
Certainly for the first sort of 10 million years or so, they do not, or even 100 million years, they certainly do not mix very well. Over sufficiently long timescales, of course, they will somehow mix. Because, of course, the cluster itself, the picture I've described works very well if you have a cluster that is very stable, very static, all spherically symmetric, and everything's falling in along the radius. The moment you have something which is in real space, you tend to have, as these clusters form from this cosmic web that has formed after the Big Bang, so these filaments and voids all come together. And the cluster tends to get fed down some of these filaments, and there's sort of all kinds of motions of the gas as well. It all gets a little bit more complicated.
I was going to ask how the fact that these clusters of galaxies haven't finished their evolution, how this will be affected then as the clusters continue to evolve and to go to their final state.
Well, so what we tend to find is that if the clusters are sufficiently... still evolving, they're still you've got two clusters that are merging, there's lots of motions of the gas and things of that sort. That sort of motion, the collision of gas particles as clusters collide and things of that sort, those are also very good at keeping energy into the surrounding area, into the cluster itself. But the moment the clusters sort of become a bit more sedate in its middle age, let's say, then you end up with a comparatively nice spherical or elliptic setup. And then this process seems to be more common. In terms of the future evolution, it's one of those things that if this feedback scenario is what is going on, then if you do end up with almost a steady state, at least steady state over a long timescale, because what could happen, of course, is that a load of the gas cools, it all flows inwards, the black hole does an almighty ejection of stuff, which prevents all the gas from cooling for a long time, and you end up with a very short active period and a long cooling period. But over time, this steady state could mean that it just continues in this sort of steady state feedback loop driven scenario.
So if I can then move on to what you've been researching currently, you kept your work with black holes and X-rays, but you're now looking at binary systems.
Yes. It's one of those things where not quite from one day to the next, but certainly between one job and another, I changed mass scale by a factor of over a million, which is quite fun.
How many people can say that?
Yes. So yes. Although I'm still working on these bubbles and clusters and also on galaxy scale levels, I'm also now working on X-ray binaries. Now, It's a term that's very descriptive. It's a binary star system that emits X-rays. But in more detail, what is going on, at least in the ones that I'm studying, is that initially there was a binary system of two stars, one more massive than the other. More massive stars evolve more quickly. They go through their life cycle very rapidly. And if they're sufficiently massive at the end of their life, they will explode in a supernova. And if we're lucky, they will form a black hole. And these black holes that are left have a mass of around 10 times the mass of our sun. The other star, if it survives all this, remains in the binary system. And when you suddenly have a black hole and a companion star, especially when the companion star itself starts swelling towards the end of its life, forming either a red giant or that sort of idea, you can end up with mass from the still intact star being transferred onto the black hole. The black hole is almost still the more massive partner in the system. So you end up with the material falling onto the black hole and forming an accretion disk. And it's a bit like water going round the plug hole in the bath, where the stuff closer towards the plug hole, closer towards the black hole, is orbiting, swirling faster than the stuff on the outside. And because each different circular region is travelling slightly faster or slower than the one next to it, you end up with basically frictional heating between the different parts of the disk. Yeah, if you rub your hands together, they get hot. Well, if you rub gas together outside of a black hole, it gets very hot and emits X-rays. And therefore, if we look at the X-ray emission from these X-ray binaries, we can study what's going on very close in towards the black hole, which is quite nice because you want to study exactly how the material behaves right close to the center, and if you're lucky you can start getting effects from general relativity because of the bending of the space-time by the black hole itself. In fact, when X-ray astronomy came of age, now it's been 1950s, 1960s, one of the first sources that was seen outside of our own solar system, by pure serendipity, was one of these X-ray binary systems. I think it was one in which a neutron star is the more massive companion rather than the black hole. It kick-started sort of the next 50 years of X-ray astronomy quite effectively. If you have your mental image of an X-ray binary, you've got a black hole, you've got a disk, and you've got the donor star next to it supplying this disk of material. And then you look at your active galactic nucleus, where you've got, okay, a black hole that's a million times bigger or a billion times bigger, also with the disk. All that's different between the two is that one has a donor star, and one is, you know, a million to a billion times larger. Possibly if you look at one type of black hole that's active, an X-ray binary, you may find out things about the other type of black hole, a supermassive black hole at the centre of a galaxy or even a cluster of galaxies, as I talked about earlier. The advantage of doing this is that black holes which have got, let's say, a billion times the mass of our Sun, they're quite lumbering beasts. They don't change very much over the lifetime of either a PhD student or even a full academic career. Yeah, and even I think if I submitted an observing proposal to one of the X-ray satellites, dear NASA, I would like to observe this supermassive black hole for the next 50 years. Please give me all of your satellite time for that time. I'm fairly certain I would be laughed out of the room. But what we can do is, of course, we can look at the X-ray binaries. They are smaller, and they actually vary incredibly rapidly and by large amounts. What we find is that these X-ray binaries, they undergo what are called outbursts. Basically, if you just look in the sky with your X-ray goggles on, and you look at one of these X-ray binaries over the course of a few years, you will see that its brightness will change by factors of almost 1,000, if not larger. So it'll rise in brightness by a factor of 1,000, stay quite bright for a few months, 6 months or so, and then fade back down to dim level. If we can work out what's happening there, it's quite possible that some of the X-ray supermassive black holes, these active galactic nuclei, also undergo outbursts or are permanently in a position somewhere in this outburst. Their setup is very similar to a certain position in these outbursts, so they're not all of them are very quiet, not all of them very loud, they're just halfway through and they seem to have just stuck somewhere.
So is the mechanism behind these outbursts, is it something to do with the ongoing accretion from the donor stars, or
yes, so
don't we know?
What we think is going on is that these disks are, you know, they are stable to some extent, but sometimes there will be an instability that forms in a disk. You've got something that's orbiting incredibly fast, it's incredibly hot, and you've got an gravitational interaction between the donor star and the black hole, and the gravitational field of the two combined as well. The thought is that if you have sort of too much material in the disk, it's got to go somewhere, and suddenly it all channels down towards the black hole, or just some form of instability develops that means that the material suddenly loses its ability to stay in orbit and all channels down to the centre. But what if you look at the spectrum of these X-ray binaries, you find there's almost two components. On Earth, we're used to seeing things that emit light usually are hot. Yeah, a candle flame, a red-hot poker, they may emit in the infrared, but if they emit light, they're usually warm, and therefore they have this characteristic so-called black-body spectrum. It may not be entirely correct that it's a black-body, but it's near enough. It's a very thermal spectrum that emits over a quite broad range of colours. Mm-hmm. And the X-ray-emitting disk also has a thermal sort of spectrum. The second spectral component is so-called it's a non-thermal spectrum, i.e. something that doesn't have this shape. For example, the synchrotron emission, the radio emission I talked about in the supermassive black holes from the jets, that is an example of a non-thermal emission. It's a very, very different shape across frequencies. You tend to find that all colours either emit at the same brightness or you find that there's more emitted than red, but it's a very slow graduation down towards the blue. If you could look at it with a multicolour eye, for example, you would be able to tell that one is a thermal emission and one is a non-thermal emission.
Yeah, because the black body spectrum, as I remember from my own studies, that's a very particular shape and it relates temperature to effectively colour or frequency
yes.
of light. Right.
Yeah, you tend to find that the place where most of the light is emitted is linked to the temperature of the material that's doing it. Whereas in a non-thermal emission spectrum, there is no thermal procedure behind it. You can have, it tends to be interactions with magnetic fields and things of that sort that can cause a non-thermal spectrum. Getting back to the X-ray binaries, the interplay between these two spectral components also changes as you go through this outburst. What you find is that in quiescence, you tend to find this power law spectrum dominates the emission. It's from some sort of interaction between very hot electrons and magnetic fields above the disk, is the current thought, or at least one of the current models. During the outburst, as the whole emission from the binary as a whole rises, you suddenly find that the disk becomes very, very bright and dominates the emission. And in this transition from a non-thermal, a power law dominated spectrum to a disk dominated spectrum, this occurs almost at the brightest point of the outburst itself. And certainly, getting back to the link between the X-ray binaries and the supermassive black holes, some supermassive black holes are very, very strong disks, and some of them have less strong disks. And so this interplay between the two spectral components is also something which, if we look at lots of X-ray binaries, which handily vary quite rapidly, and there's quite a few of them out and about, we can see whether, possibly learn things about how the supermassive black holes should behave, and then we can try and see whether they are out there. The advantage with X-ray binaries is, because they're all in our own galaxy, is that they're nice and close, and therefore comparatively bright. Mm-hmm. And of course, they vary over the course of a few months as opposed to over many, many years.
Because of 50 years, yes.
Or more.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for your time, Robert, and we wish you all the very best for your ongoing research.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.